dark days are done and the bright days are here. My sunny one shines so sincere. Sunny one so true. I love you.
Our next guest is one of those rare talents who has something to say and can say it funny. He's a writer-performer on the new Laugh-In and one of the most popular, outspoken, and entertaining personalities on the local news here in Los Angeles. He's won a half a dozen Emmys as a film critic and host of his own shows. Let's welcome Mr. John Barber, right over there.
Thank you. This is John Barber. That was Sarita singing Sonny and Frank Sinatra saying, "Here's Johnny." The night he hosted The Tonight Show and had me on as his first guest. And by the way, if you're interested, you can go to my site, johnbarbersworld.com, and watch the monologue I did that night. And if you like that, you can also listen to excerpts from my first comedy album. It was called It's Tough to Be White, with liner notes by Dick Gregory, which kept me off of most of the variety shows during my career, except for Dean Martin. Welcome to the Ides of March, this edition of John Barber's World Live from Las Vegas, a one-of-a-kind city where the folks come daily by the thousands in the sad hopes of getting four of a kind. Ordinarily, as you know, I like to open each show with a few, hopefully, humorous observations. There was a time I used to get paid a lot of money to write jokes about politicians to get laughs, but we don't have to do that any longer. Now to get laughs, all you have to do is quote them. As for Trump, more and more, every day, he reminds me of Andy Griffith's character, Dusty Rhodes, in Elia Kazan's fabulous A Face in the Crowd. Trump has indeed improved employment in America, especially for Alec Baldwin. Before long, our media, which daily is distracting us with misinformation that the Russians really elected him, before long, our media will be calling him President Vladimir Trump or Donald Putin. Our media would have to improve just to be a disgrace. I would like to thank right now, though, one of my Facebook friends, Norma Rogers, for posting what the media failed to report while all this distracting Russian rubbish was going on. And that was during this time legislation was introduced to terminate the Environmental Protection Agency, repeal protection of wildlife, defund Planned Parenthood, and criminalize abortion. Now, some say the abortion that should be criminalized may be our own government. I became interested in getting into television as a kid because of two people. Jack Parr, by far the best host ever of The Tonight Show, and Edward R. Murrow, the best, most dedicated journalist in the history of television. Coming from a home that would have to be repaired just to be broken long before it was popular, I never saw, as a child, or heard people having a real conversation with each other until Jack Parr. Jack made me laugh. Ed Murrow made me think. You all know these kinds of personalities and intellects have totally vanished from American mainstream television, but I found a reporter a few years ago on Russian TV whose show I never missed. Of course, there are a number of wonderful folks on the internet, James Corbett, Chris Hedges, Glenn Greenwald, a lot of them. This lady was and is in a class by herself. No one on the internet or mainstream media ever came close to the consistent excellence and accuracy of her reporting and the passion with which it was and is presented. She recently departed Russian TV and now, along with her brother Robbie, hosts the absolutely must-listen-to Media Roots. Her Empire Files video, by the way, a perfect name, Empire Files. Her video revealing the previously unknown power and influence of John Podesta, with over 500,000 instant hits, is the perfect example of journalism at its admirable best. She started out as an artist and as an aspiring informative host reporter still is. She has done more meaningful reporting in 10 years than my friend Tom Brokaw has done in 50. It is indeed an honor to welcome the irreplaceable, irrepressible Abby Martin. Abby, welcome to the show, and thank you so much for being here.
John, thank you for that amazing introduction. I'm smiling ear to ear. I really appreciate it.
Well, listen, we appreciate you a whole lot more. You are calling from where now?
Los Angeles.
Where in Los Angeles? Is that the new empty house?
That is the new empty house. We are here setting up a studio, which is really, really exciting. Just moved from New York, so it's an exciting time.
When you say we, Abby, is it you and someone else?
Yes, my partner, writing and life partner, Mike Preisner, who's also an Iraq war vet and an awesome progressive activist and a writer and everything else. So very lucky to have him in my life.
Can I ask you a question about
sure.
Mike? You know, it's amazing. When you're a fan of somebody, as I am of yours, and I read all about you, sometimes I come across a piece of information I just cannot get out of my mind because it's never answered. So it goes back to when you were a student mm-hmm. in California, and it said that the Iraq, just after 9/11, the Iraq war was just starting, and you had a boyfriend who was enlisting to go and fight for America. And you began, isn't it interesting that the really good things that seem to happen in life happen by accident, while all the disasters are well planned, and it seemed to be an accident that you somehow became this media maverick because of something you wrote at that time. Could you tell us what it is, and was that young man Mike?
You know what? No, and it's so fascinating how life comes, you know, back in a circle. You know, I was just a typical kind of vapid, vacuous airhead in high school, really with no political ideology at all, other than just growing up in a staunchly Democratic family and kind of vaguely being pro-Clinton, you know. But yeah, my high school sweetheart at the time had joined the Army because of 9/11, to quote, kill ragheads, seriously. And so he goes off to boot camp, became a complete a-hole. Without even going to war yet, you know, became a completely abusive psychopath. So I kind of realized before even going to war what the military does to someone, and that kind of indoctrination to strip you of your soul and to just strip you of any sort of identity whatsoever. And so at the same time, I was also going to college and taking classes about what the hell the U.S. government has been doing to its people and to the rest of the world for the last century. So as I was learning more and more and reading Chalmers Johnson and kind of understanding the implications of militarism, you know, of course I could no longer be with my partner at the time, who was becoming more and more militaristic and more right-wing. So it just fueled my fire even more. I was so curious to learn, you know, why do these things happen and how did this happen? And kind of investigating 9/11 more and uncovering things that we weren't being told by the media, and then seeing, you know, it snowball into the media then selling us the Iraq war, lockstep, both parties. At the same time, you had Nancy Pelosi saying impeachment was off the table, and I just couldn't figure out, you know, it wasn't just Bush, it wasn't just Cheney, it was the Democrats, and it wasn't just the Democrats, it was the media. And so it just became more obvious over time as you research the oligarchy and capitalism and why these things are convoluted and obfuscated from the American people. And, of course, going that route, I just said, well, I have to become the media. If the media is lying to us and it's owned by the same people and they're all working together to sell this narrative, then hey, we got to do something about it. We have to become these mediums and become these channels of communication and information. And so I just took charge of becoming kind of an activist journalist and going out there in my community and putting out that information that I felt was super underreported. And in a town like San Diego, where I went to college, I mean, there's 5 military bases. It was no easy feat. But it just, I never stopped, John, and I've been going nonstop ever since.
Abby, a very quick question. You mentioned something that absolutely, totally rang a heartbreaking bell with me, that your boyfriend in high school ended up becoming what you call an a-hole.
Yes.
I was just 15 years of age in Toronto. I had an older half-brother. His name was Raymond. He was 17. Coming from a broken home, he left Canada and joined the U.S. Air Force and was stationed at the Keesler Air Force Base. Now, he's not American, right? He was Canadian, so he goes down and he just has to get away from this broken home. I was a hockey junkie. My closest friend was a black kid from a reformatory. We were on the same hockey team. My brother came back a year and a half later with this weird accent. He saw me sitting with this black kid. He took a beer bottle and broke it and tried to kill him. I never spoke to my brother again, and I was shocked that within a year and a half, how could a 17 or 18-year-old be turned into a homicidal killer? How did they do that?
Oh, my God, that's so horrible to hear. Well, I mean, that's what they do. I mean, you go in, and it says you're no longer you. You are property of the United States government, and they do everything they can to dehumanize not only the people that you're set out to kill and maim and torture, but you. You know, your humanity is stripped down. You're no longer human, and therefore you don't have a conscience. You don't have any agency.
You can see, as in the case of your boyfriend, when he got into the service, they didn't torture him. They didn't really sort of brainwash him. But all of a sudden, he's changed. So it must give you some idea. If they can do that to a student who is becoming a soldier, it is no wonder they're able to do that with the entire population by constantly misinforming them. Now, you become this sort of activist. What was the next step beyond that? Now, I know you're an artist. Could I say something about your art obviously began before your politics, right?
Yes, yeah. Grew up in an artistic family, a ceramic shop in my grandma's house, and was always such a huge part of my childhood, for sure.
Were you sort of saddened because you were distracted from the thing that you loved to do from a child, which was your art, to becoming this media maverick?
You know, I never married the two. I didn't even think to use art as a vehicle for political activism or political expression until much later. And I'd always used art as kind of a secondary hub for me to have kind of a psychological outlet for all the horrible things that I was researching and doing on a daily basis. So art was always kind of a hobby, something that I can channel my my negative energy into, I guess, into creating something positive and beautiful with that. But it was always kind of abstract, ethereal, until I would say about 6 years ago is when I finally tried to channel all my political energy into creating only a political art installation, and that was one of the proudest moments when I can marry both of my passions together and tell a story through imagery, which I think is something that reaches everyone in such a different way, because my journalism and the way that I approach news can really turn people off.
No, it does not turn people on, too,
which is great, like
no,
you, John.
It turns people on. And as for your art, I would encourage anyone to go to your site. I've been trying to decide for the last 2 weeks. I've been looking at all of the art on your site. It's enormously visually powerful, and it's also visually disturbing. And I hope you don't mind, as a former
critic. No, that's great.
As a movie critic, I would say this. Your art strikes me as Jackson Pollock with a purpose.
I love that, because I always didn't. Jackson Pollock annoys the hell out of me, because I have such OCD, and every dot really does serve a purpose. Every dot, every swirl, every line, and I'll look at a Jackson Pollock painting and just want to pull my hair out.
I must tell you, it is Jackson Pollock with purpose. There are a couple that I really,
I'm stealing
really
that quote, John.
Well, you're welcome to it. Okay, now we get to the business of you as a journalist, where my affection for you lies. Okay, how do you get your first paid job?
You know, that's the age-old question, isn't it? How do you get paid for what you're doing? You know, I never expected to actually make money doing this. I was always working as a waitress and as a hostess and doing odd jobs around wherever I lived, and supplementing my income through art and things like that. And then, you know, just teaching myself everything, video editing, filming, writing, all of these skills honing in on what I created, which was MediaRoots.org, which is that grassroots independent organization that I wanted to channel citizen journalism and host other artists and activists on this platform in the Bay Area. And so doing that, I never expected to get paid. I never tried to get paid because I knew how abysmal the media climate was, John. I looked at the six corporations controlling 90% of everything we see, hear, and read. And I knew I don't want to get paid by these organizations. I never want to sell out. I will never sell out. So it was never even an option, you know, to try to fight to build my career up from the ground up with any of these outlets at all. And so I just kind of always was trying to build my own path and create my own audience, grassroots truth-telling, never compromising on that. And so there always was kind of an audience that was there. But covering Occupy Oakland, that's when the police state exploded in my backyard. I was always covering stuff in Oakland. There was the crackdown on the cannabis clubs. There was a lot of stuff going on there. There was the Oscar Grant stuff that was happening. But then when Occupy Oakland happened, I've never seen the police presence that I had until then. And I just knew that I had to be out there with my camera every day, all day, filming whatever was going on. And, you know, I saw this Russian network out there, Russia Today. And it was really the only professional media organization that was on the ground covering this incredible spontaneous movement that had really encapsulated so much energy. And really, you know, in the height of the Obama administration at that you have this kind of leftist outlier group taking to the streets and occupying public spaces, it was a beautiful thing to see. But of course, it was completely mocked by all of the mainstream media. So I was really curious. I said, what is this Russian channel? Hey, you know what? I don't care. I'm glad that they're out here, and I'm glad that they're covering Occupy. It's incredible. So I kind of became the liaison for the D.C. Bureau, the Moscow Bureau, telling the stories of what was going on in Oakland.
So in essence, Abby, they hired you and
they
paid
did.
You. Okay. Now, what was the first story you did for pay? Do you recall?
Did for pay? Well, the first story I did, it wasn't even a story. I just, they hired me and moved me there. I mean, I had done stuff for Project Censored and gotten money, like filming their talks and stuff like that. But actually, a professional media job was getting swept up and moving to D.C. and just going full speed ahead within a month.
Old,
I had that show.
How old were you at the time?
Oh, I was 28, 27 going on 28 when they hired me. So, yeah.
Were you there by yourself?
I was. They swept me up, and I said that the last place on earth I want to be is D.C. It sounds horrible, sterile. Like a vacuum, vacuous culture void. But I just said, you know, I can't miss this opportunity. I have to do it, obviously. Otherwise, I'll always regret it. So I just said, hey, I have to do it, an international platform to speak whatever the hell I want. And they really did. I mean, they really gave me that platform and let me do whatever I wanted. And it was incredible, you know, really the antithesis of this cartoonish depiction of Russian propaganda that you hear today.
I did two of my closest friends for years. I mentioned Tom Brokaw at the top, and of course I was on with Tom Snyder for 5 years in Los Angeles, and both of them, I remember making a comment about Tom Snyder that he was a kind of anchor man that gave you the impression the news was there to bring you him, which was a line that Time magazine quoted the following week. But these two had enormous ambitions to be famous. I never got the impression that you ever wanted to be famous, that you only wanted to be heard. Now, you're in Washington for about, 2 years before they pick you to do a show? And then how did that happen?
You know, that's actually wrong on Wikipedia. I got picked to do a show immediately. I started off as an anchor, and then within a month, I was always kind of being prepped to do a show because I was so opinionated. They put me on the anchor desk, and I just was immediately talking about the TSA, and they were like, you need to shut up. And I said, I don't know how to be a journalist. I have opinions. I can't shut up. I'm not just going to sit back and not say what I think. So they said, okay, this isn't going to work for you here. And within that time, Alona, the woman who had that primetime slot before me, had left. And so they said, hey, you're up. 2 weeks. Get training. So for 2 weeks, we figured out the name of the show. We figured out the look. We figured out how it was going to be, all the different segments. And I had 2 weeks to train and went out guns blazing, John, and haven't looked back.
Was that the one called Breaking the Set?
It was indeed, yep.
I must tell you, you were the best. There was absolutely no one on the internet. There was no one anywhere who did these stories as completely and as fully as you. Now, they always sounded objective, and yet there was this great undercurrent of opinion that you never really verbalized, but we always got that impression. I mean, you, Abby, truthfully, you were amazing.
Thank you, John. That's incredible to hear.
Okay, now, you're doing this on Russian TV. You must have become their most popular host on that network. And then
I'll tell you one thing that I've learned about Russian culture. They don't really like to give you compliments very much. So I never knew if they really thought that, but I know a lot of people did really enjoy the show, and it was incredible to just go out there and rail against so many things that you would just never hear on corporate-controlled media. I mean, that's the beauty of state media, is you can rail against corporations, you can rail against militarism, the U.S. Empire, Obama, every day. It's a beautiful, beautiful thing. So, even when I was in Palestine last year, everyone there knew me, because you do not see anchors on TV talking about Israel in the way that I was able to talk about it. So
this morning, incredible. I got a wonderful note from a filmmaker in Brazil named Sandra da Silva. Said she can't wait to see you because you're her biggest hero in the world.
Oh,
Abby,
that's so
Abby.
Sweet. Tell her thank you. Thank you very much.
Isn't there a fellow also on Russian TV? I don't get to see him by the name of Max Kaiser.
He is. Yep, the Kaiser Report. He is a wacky dude.
Now, is Max is an American also, right?
He is, yep.
And he has one, like you, one of the most popular shows on Russian TV at the time?
Indeed, yep. Him and his wife, Stacy, host a really wonky economic show where he goes off on a lot of crazy rants, and he's definitely a character. Yeah, their show's still wildly popular on RT, for sure.
Why on earth would you leave such a magnificent platform with such a huge audience over which you had an enormous impact and influence?
Well, a lot of reasons, John. One of them was management. You know, just like every other job, you conflict with your management, and me and the management at DC wasn't really on the same page. I was, putting so much heart and soul and passion day in and day out into something like that. It got to a point where I felt like I needed to pull back at least a day. And I told him, I said, can I just do 4 days a week? And he just said no. And my staff was dwindling. And there was a lot of different reasons. But I also kind of, it was getting to the point where it was really hard to kind of react to this superficial news cycle that's churned out by these garbage anchors and garbage corporations that set the narrative for you with no context and no real deep analysis about how these problems arise and how we can really, really fix the system. And so I felt like, hey, I really, really want to dig into the meat, tell these stories in a really complex way, break it down, make these issues timeless, and really investigate. I love nothing more, like I'm sure many reporters do, than going to the heart of the story, talking to the people affected on the ground. And I feel like being in that studio, I felt almost too removed from what I was talking about, and I felt like I need to go to Palestine. I need to talk to Palestinians. I need to see what the occupation's like with my own eyes. I need to go to Flint. I need to go to Cuba. Let's see what's going on. And RT just didn't mesh with what I was envisioning for the next step in my career or the next step in what my passion really was leading me for that moment in time. But I'm definitely open to working with them in the future. I think the network's super important, just like all these other state networks are really important, gives you a really necessary perspective that U.S. media doesn't. So I couldn't be happier with where I am right now, which is with Telesur, which is the Latin American state broadcasting network, which allows me to do whatever I want. I set whatever I want to do. Mike and I are traveling around the world and telling the stories that we want to tell and taking the time that we need to tell them. And they're timeless forever, John, and that's what's so beautiful about this show, is every week is another chapter unarchiving these hidden stories about the marginalized and oppressed that have
well,
been
a lot
crushed
of, a lot of the happiness
so
that you undoubtedly feel about your work is inspired by the fact that you have Mike.
Yeah.
Now, I need to ask you about Mike, since your first boyfriend turned into an a-hole. How did you happen to find this guy?
Well, at RT, I saw this guy going on RT who was a Iraq veteran, and he was amazing. I'd never seen someone who was an Iraq war veteran or just a veteran in general able to speak so openly about how brutal, you know, the Iraq war was and how they were essentially the real terrorists. And, you know, the truth, the brutal honesty about what we were doing over there. And I was just enthralled. I said, who the hell is this guy? And so I hunted him down, let's say. And then I found this viral speech that everyone can check out online where he's talking about at Winter Soldier, this famous speech. It's probably the most famous speech by any Iraq war veteran in the world.
Is that the mic?
Yes.
Oh, my gosh, you lucky devil, you. How wonderful is that?
It's so great. It's a very wonderful meeting of the minds. I feel very lucky.
It's accidental serendipity. Now, it seems to me that America is a truly, truly divided country. When I started in television and originated the AM show on ABC in Los Angeles in 1970, a corporation could only own 5 newspapers or 5 television stations in the country. There were 1,500 owners of TV stations in America at the time. And then Clinton signs the Telecommunications Act in 96, and now 96% of it is owned by 5 or 6 corporations. It can never, ever be restored. So you and I are literally living in a divided country. It's almost like an occupied country.
Oh, you know, people do not realize this, John, and I think that that's why it's so unique in America. Of course, everyone thinks that we're the greatest country in the world. We're the best democracy, the freest, right? We have the most information. Actually, that's not true at all. And in fact, it's so much harder to convince people what the reality really is, which is that we are almost one of the most closed off, ignorant, least exceptional places in the world. But because we've been sold and we've been indoctrinated into this narrative, and it's so much harder. It's kind of like the myth of the liberal media. You know, I grew up thinking, you know, hearing that all the time. Oh, the liberal media. Well, then you realize the media is not liberal. It's conservative. It's owned by freaking businessmen who have one goal, making money and making more money every year. And how do they do that? Ratings. And what sells? Fear. And what sells? Trump. Les Moonves said it himself, the director of CBS. He said, Trump is horrible for America, but he's damn good for CBS. And if that doesn't sum up the media in one sentence, then I don't know what does.
You know, at one point when Merv Griffin left Westinghouse to go to CBS, he had recommended me as his replacement for his show, and they put me under contract. And the producer that was going to produce my show was a very young and very handsome, very thin Roger Ailes.
He used to be handsome?
I must tell you, it looks like he went on Orson Welles' diet, for crying out loud. But honest to God, he was an extremely attractive young man. But he told me even then, it was 1969, he came out to Las Vegas. So I was opening for a great singer named John Gary, and he came to see my act, and we sat down and he talked about the news, even as a kid who was interested in the news. And he says, John, you don't change anything by what you report in the news, you change it by what you don't report. And that became his philosophy when he got to Fox News. I do not see anything improving in America. But what I do see, because of people like you, Abby, and Joseph Tilley, whom we're going to meet in just a moment, and scores of others, is a lot of the best reporting is being done by you independent people on the internet.
And that's really the only hope we have. People are realizing that more and more. You know, distrust in mainstream media is at an all-time high, and I really do believe that that is why Trump won. You can talk about the Christian right, you can talk about the alt-right and the power that they have, but if the media wasn't so distrusted and disliked. I mean, I think it's below 30%. And when you look at millennials and people even below millennials, they hate the media. They totally tune out the media. It's dinosaur media to them. So really, I blame the media on Trump's win, and I think it's a really beautiful symbol of where we are to come, because that's great, John. Let them die off. But when you look at, you know, when the media is lockstep behind one candidate, of course people are going to reject that. So I think that that is a really, really great sign that people understand, okay, that's a huge problem. They're not telling us the truth. But, you know, the internet's so overly saturated with bad stuff. It's really, really hard to get your voice heard and to get these platforms supported. And, you know, all these journalists are just begging for donations to stay afloat. It's completely pathetic. We live in a country that loves to lionize journalism and create all these movies and shows about it, but doesn't give a damn about funding it.
Never, never. I've just spent the last 6.5 months doing a documentary called The American Media and the Second Assassination of President John F. Kennedy. It's called Part Two of the Garrison Tapes. The documentary I did about Jim Garrison in 1992 won the San Sebastian Film Festival Award. Jim Garrison gave only one interview after he lost the trial of Clay Shaw, and that was to me because I had created Real People and had tried a number of times to get him on the air, and I kept getting fired every time I booked him on a show. And that film never got seen, actually, in the United States, even though it's a huge hit around the world. Now, people who do not care about the murder of John Kennedy still know and feel today the entire corruption of the American media. The astonishing thing is, Abby, that Jim Garrison, investigating the murder of John Kennedy, investigated the history of the CIA and why it was formed and how the CIA, in order to control foreign policy in America, created a project called Project Mockingbird to infiltrate the entire media, which they did successfully. And he found a couple of major media corporations that supported the killing of Kennedy before Dallas, and how all of them surrounded the wagons of the Central Intelligence Agency to protect the murders after Dallas. It is, I must tell you, Abby, it is the most astonishing, astonishing story about the history of the corruption of the media that you'll ever see. And hopefully we'll have it out in about a month. And as soon as I get it done, I would love to send you and Robbie a copy so that you could look at it.
Oh, that sounds amazing. I mean, another fascinating part of that story is the term conspiracy theory was never really in the public lexicon, especially in media outlets, disseminated in the way that it is today to shut down critical thinking and debate. It was completely injected by the CIA. This is a documented campaign. I read the documents myself. I sound like Alex Jones. I have the documents. But no, that is a thing. And you see it infiltrated, creeping in to completely quell any sort of investigation into the JFK assassination whatsoever. And since then, of course, we know what's been happened with the term. It's been completely weaponized to shut you down any analysis about the crimes of the deep state.
You'll be thrilled to know that you had on your show the fella who wrote Conspiracy Theory. It was a history of how the CIA had created this conspiracy theory to really interfere with serious students of the investigation, to call it, say it was communist propaganda and the rest of them. I forget the fellow's name, but I took the clip from your show, which is included in the documentary.
His name is Lance DeHaven Smith, and he has a great book that everyone should check out.
That is exactly right. Anyway, we're going to take a brief break right now, Abby, and we're going to be joined by somebody that you will absolutely love. His name is Joe Satilli. I could not do this show without him. He writes the greatest newsletter in America. It's called News Vandal. We'll be right back with the incredible Abby Martin and Joe Satilli.
Great music from all the greatest performers from sunup to sundown.
How do you keep playing
at last?
Beyond the sea.
Then, great talk all night. The mysteries of UFOs. conspiracy theories, and the true story of Las Vegas that has never been told.
There are three ways to listen to KIYQ. Go to the TuneIn app, just search for KIYQ, or go to www.kiyq.org. Listen from any telephone, call 605-477-2857. That's 605-477-2857. Long distance charges may apply.
KIYQ, 107.1.
Hi, this is John Barber of John Barber's World every other Monday at 5 p.m. Pacific right here on VBS Radio. I'm telling you about a terrific show, The New Criminal Minds with outstanding actor Gary Sinise, called Criminal Minds Beyond Borders, a tough drama about a special unit of the FBI involved in protecting Americans who are beyond borders. It follows the regular Criminal Minds, airing every Wednesday at 10 p.m. Eastern, 9 Central. Don't miss it. Gary Sinise is outstanding.
Hi, I'm Richard Valzer. This is the great VBS Radio.
Thank you for that smile upon your face, oh sunny.
Hi, this is John Barber. You may remember me as the co-host, producer, and creator of Real People, America's first reality show, or most recently as the writer-director of what's been called the definitive documentary on JFK's murder, The Last Word on the Assassination. Now I'm doing a show every other Monday from 5 to 6 Pacific Time on BBS. You'll hear provocative views, unreported news, and film reviews from me with outstanding guests and you. Join me on John Barber's World.
You're listening to BBS Radio. If it's not mainstream, it's on bbsradio.com.
Those of you who have an ongoing interest in the JFK assassination might want to know about this. TV producer John Barber. He put together a dream team of JFK researchers, including Coast regular Jim Mars and world-class JFK writers Dick Russell and Joan Mellon. They all got together at UNLV in front of a live audience. They had a screening of Barber's terrific, and I'd say historic, film based on interviews with prosecutor Jim Garrison of New Orleans. And then after the film was shown, the experts all talked about the latest JFK theories and evidence. It's now out on a DVD. Terrific stuff. I'm George Knack, Coast to Coast AM.
Welcome back to John Barber's World, and my very, very favorite person on the internet, Abby Martin, who tried for 2 years to get on the show, and she's just wonderful. And she's now joined by my sidekick and dear friend, without whom I could not do this show and without whom I could not have finished the documentary, The American Media and the Second Assassination of President John F. Kennedy, a great journalist and reporter, Joe Satilli. Joe, welcome to the show. Say hello to Abby.
Thank you, John. Hello, Abby.
Hello.
I actually am like a sidekick. Say hello to Abby. I guess that would would that make you Edgar Bergen, John?
Okay. What I need to ask the two of you, because Abby mentioned Trump earlier, and about 10 or 12 of the really interesting article today in your newest news vandal is about Donald Trump. So tell us a little bit about Donald Trump. Tell us and explain to us why this horrifying distraction of the Russians supposedly getting this guy elected, please.
Which one? You want me to go for it?
Both of you.
Go for it first, my friend.
No, well, I would like to ask Abby's opinion because, you know, I have opinions, and we have cobbled together sort of a weird mosaic of facts and assertions. Obviously, the Rosetta Stone here is whether or not the Russians actually were involved in hacking the DNC and whether that information was then transferred to a third party, and that third party gave it to WikiLeaks. Because The one thing that Julian Assange was careful to do was be very lawyerly in his response into whether or not he was given the information by the Russians. He said, no, I was not. It was not given to me by a state party actor. So, in other words, there could have been an intermediary. There's an open door there.
Joe, I hate. Hang on just a second. I hate to interrupt you, but my instincts tell me it had nothing to do with the Russians. It was just some disaffected somebody involved with the Democratic Party who just could not stand the thought of this woman becoming president of the United States, could not stand John Podesta, and he's the person that had
to. And that's one of the operating theses about the hack, that it was actually a leak from somebody who was disaffected because they were upset that Bernie Sanders got railroaded. That's sort of a fairly well-established theory. The question here is that if there is evidence, we haven't seen the evidence. We haven't seen the hard evidence. And this is one of the beauties of being in the national security state, is you could say, well, we have the evidence, but you have to trust us, because if we release the evidence, we're going to be releasing sources and methods, and as a matter of fact, we may be revealing an inside source, a person we have placed, for instance, in this case, somebody inside the Kremlin, human intelligence, HUMINT, as opposed to SIGINT, signal intelligence, somebody who actually has given us direct knowledge that we can't expose because then their life would be in jeopardy. So it's kind of a wonderful little circular argument that protects them. Now, the rub on this, and I think that the primary rub here, the rubber meets the road, is Paul Manafort. Because Paul Manafort does have some very odd connections and some money that has been exchanged. And there's a reason why he left the campaign when he did. So Paul Manafort could be firewalled off and be the person who ends up being the source of the scandal. But the reason why we're being distracted by this, I think, is in no small part because Donald Trump continues to throw kindling on the fire.
Well, how does he do that?
Well, over the weekend, you get on Twitter and you're sitting on the John and you start going off on claims about Obama directly ordering a wiretap, and that continues to stoke it. He continues to stoke it because what he's trying to do is counterattack in the media narrative, because in a sense, I think what Donald Trump thinks is that he can play the media, the national media, much in the way he played the tabloids in the 80s when he used to pose as his own press agent to tout his sexual conquests in the nightclub life of Manhattan.
That's true, but the CIA has long publicly supported Obama, and they have said publicly, he is our president and we like him. And obviously a number of people think that from the very beginning, he may have even been groomed by the CIA, as was Clinton with CIA when he was supposedly a Rhodes Scholar. Okay, so it is not unlikely that Obama had Trump tapped. I mean, Nixon did it. Why wouldn't?
No. That's not how it works anymore. See, there's so much plausible deniability built into the system, and I think the bigger story here, and I think the story that I think is the interesting story, is that the national security state, and particularly the NSA, has us all under surveillance all the time. They never metadata they didn't like. That's why they call it metadata.
that's what I thought when I saw Trump tweeting that. I was like, well, yeah, isn't that the thing? Is that we're all, everyone's being collected? It's like, what makes you think that you were special, Trump?
Well, that's exactly
no. I mean, the whole
point.
Thing's insane. I think and the DNI report that came out, that long-awaited report that really was supposed to be a slam dunk of the evidence, was just nothing but a giant document bashing RT. It was completely mortifying. I think that they are trying as hard as they can to unseat Trump, to start impeachment proceedings. I honestly agree with you, John. I think it's much more likely that's a disgruntled, maybe FBI employee, as there's this warring fight between, you know, the factions of the deep state, the CIA versus the FBI. Who knows? I just feel like it's much more likely, because I just don't see the motive, nor do I see really how it's helping Russia right now. As we can see, Trump has done nothing but actually continue the hostility unabated. John?
The hostility toward Russia, I don't get that impression, Abby, so much. I think the establishment is mostly upset about Trump because The establishment makes their money for the 1% with fake wars. Trump has made his money with buildings and hotels and golf courses. In other words, is sort of a businessman who has gamed the system with all of his successful bankruptcies. He still may see Russia as a customer, whereas the 1%, the warmongers, see Russians as potential targets. That's the reading that I get from it.
I would agree with you if he wasn't already trying to start wars with Iran and North Korea right off the gate.
And Yemen. Yemen is actually going to be where the first real escalation begins, because we've now gone from seeing drone strikes to airstrikes. There were 20 airstrikes over the weekend. And he, over dinner, okayed this raid into Yemen, which was definitely an escalation. And, you know, Yemen, here's one of the little subtexts here, is that the Saudis and the Gulf states are very, very pleased with a Trump presidency because they were very, very displeased with Obama.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't particularly care for Obama. And based on certain things that I've read and seen, I don't think Obama really cared much for them. And so they really would like to complete this thing in Yemen as a proxy war with Iran. And I think, as Abby is saying, that this is one of the things that's on Trump's front burner. And it's actually something that's turning into an ongoing and quite underreported humanitarian disaster inside Yemen.
And even if Trump, maybe he lacks obvious political ideology, he's just completely inept. But really, when you look at the people behind him, I mean, Steve Bannon is a terrifying character who really has said, we are going to have a shooting war in the Middle East in the next 5 years, and we are going to war with expansionist China and expansionist Islam. This is a man who knows exactly what he wants. You can see his fingerprints and writing all over the executive orders that are being rammed through. And this guy hates even Asian immigrants. I mean, he wants no immigrants whatsoever in this country. A completely white ethno-nationalist state is his agenda. So Trump is a complete patsy, putty in the hands of these people that he surrounded himself with.
Abby, I'd like to ask you a question.
Mm-hmm.
You've been around the world. You've done alt media. You've looked at a lot of media. You've consumed a lot of media, a lot of state media, a lot of major international networks like Deutsche Welle, BBC, TASS. Where do you go to get information?
What a great question.
This is going to sound so lame, but I curate it all through a Twitter account that I have, and I just follow, and I think that's the best way to do it, is follow the journalist that you trust the most. Not even necessarily, I trust this network, because I really don't trust any networks blanketly. I encourage everyone to consume news from an array of different sources, obviously become media literate. I hate hearing this term fake news being weaponized and being used against non-corporate media. It's a huge shame, and of course Trump is using it now against all media that doesn't worship him. So I just encourage people, I know it's a very daunting task, but to go through a lot of different channels every day and consume it all, whether it be Breitbart, so you can understand the angles that are being put out of these stories, and the differentiation between maybe the core story to how these outlets flip that narrative. It is shameful to say that I do use Twitter as kind of that hub to source and get a direct feed of all the networks and journalists that I specifically support. Yeah,
could you, Abby, could you name one or two of these journalists whose stories you research and accept and believe in? And then tell me also a little bit about Project Censored. I used to hear all the time on the internet stories that were uncovered by Project Censored. Now it seems unless I go to that site, I cannot find those stories anymore.
Yeah, so Max Blumenthal, Rania Kallik, Ben Norton, Democracy Now, of course, Counterpunch, my brother, Robbie Martin, Telesur, RT, Drudge Report is great because you can see what they aggregate and how it gets out to the Breitbarts and InfoWars. Just understanding how that media machine is spun and how that sausage is made. Project Censored is amazing. It's the largest research organization that's completely grassroots, student-based. non-state, non-corporate funded organization in the entire world, I think. Hundreds, if not thousands, of students are pulling together research and writing for their annual book that they publish. I'm honored to be on the board, one of the youngest board members on Project Censored, and it's an incredible organization. They aggregate just underreported stories, and they have all of their members vote on what they think is the most monumental covered up stories. And of course, when we're talking about censorship, it's not the black hand of the state coming down and the government blacking out a story. That's not the way it works. It's obviously the slant. It's the obfuscation. It's the way that these stories are manipulated or backpaged. You know, New York Times could say, oh, we didn't censor the lead levels in all these other cities. Well, yeah, you might not have outright not talked about it, but it was backpaged on, you know, E17 on the bottom right corner in an addendum. So that's how censorship works nowadays. It's really, really unfortunate. So Project Censored really works strenuously to highlight and lift up the stories that they feel most impact the people in this country and their communities, because that's what a democracy should be, is when you have an informed citizenry being able to take action about the information in their own home. And that's the opposite of what we have in this country. It's a disgrace.
Well, you must feel terribly, terribly encouraged, because having thousands of people involved with a project like Project Censored, and you get the opportunity to work with them, you're working with a majority of people who are really working for something good and something decent. So that must make you feel wonderful. But for the rest of us who are not surrounded by those kind of people, it is depressing out here.
Believe me, I'm depressed too, John. I'm not around these people at all. I feel very isolated sometimes. You know, but it's beautiful to talk to people like you guys. I mean, to be honest, when you go out and you just kind of spark up a casual conversation with people in the streets or in a store, you kind of realize that there is this general malaise. People are walking around like zombies, kind of in disbelief that this is the country that we're living in. So I think it's a great opportunity. People are awakened to how horrible things are. Their perception is very heightened. They know that things are escalating at a very rapid pace. And so this is our time. It's our time to take that narrative back, to take the country back, and to really get out there and get involved and build solidarity. And you'd be surprised at how many people I just kind of bring something up, or they see a pin that I'm wearing, and you just start this giant conversation. And the next thing you know, they want to come out in the streets and protest or get involved or watch the show. And I just think it's a beautiful time to be alive, and I think that the lotus flower grows out of the mud, and the phoenix will rise again. I know it's very cliche and stupid, but I really do believe that something very positive and profound can happen the more people get disenchanted and disengage with the system that we have now, because it is an abysmal failure. If there's one thing that Donald Trump has proven, look at what a joke he's made the empire. It's a disgrace. The rest of the world is looking at us. The mask is off, baby. This is it. Donald Trump, baby!
Yeah, it's like Walt Kelly in the 1970s in Pogo. That cartoon, he said, I met the enemy and he is us. And there's a picture of Donald Trump, for crying out loud. Now, Joe, you asked that great question of Abby. Where do you go to get some of the wonderful stuff that you put into your news vandal?
Well, I visit about 300, 400 websites every week. So, you know, what Abby was talking about is definitely, as you know, John, from reading what I do, I will put The Nation next to Breitbart. I go to American Thinker. Not a lot of people go to American Thinker, but if you want to see the underbelly of Bannon's world, you go to American Thinker, and you put American Thinker next to Mother Jones or next to Jacobin or next to Dissent, and you have to juxtapose source material. Now, you know, I like to look at all of the majors. I find that for myself, I take respite in BBC World coverage, because BBC will actually put a reporter in South Asia in an impoverished village, and you can see how people are living in impoverished villages in South Asia. BBC is one of the only news outlets that I've seen that's actually covered a wedding that was bombed using U.S. cluster bombs by the Saudis in Yemen. So I rely on that to keep me grounded. But mostly everything that I consume, I try and find specific reporters in outlets, because outlets are not necessarily monolithic, and you can actually find somebody who will, like a Liz Doucette for the BBC, who will actually give you some information that you may not otherwise get. But it
well,
you have
Joe,
to be very, very careful.
Joe, I've got to tell you, I found the two best somebodies in the world, and that's you and Abby Martin. Abby, again, I thank you so, so much for being here. In the next week or two, I'm going to go back to your art site and find myself a painting that I wish to buy. Joe, when are you going to be on Ocelli again?
Be on Ocelli tomorrow, and then, of course, Inside the Headlines on Friday, KRUUFM, and then back here in a couple weeks, John.
Oh, well, thank you both again so much. And as Ed Murrow used to say, good night and good luck.
Peace out, you guys.
You're my spark of nature's fire. You're my sweet, complete desire. A sunny, 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 sunny. I love you.